Hearing the music in the background is it's fading. So it is full moon. It'll be full moon tomorrow on Good Friday at 4:12 a.m. Pacific Daylight Time. We remember that Good Friday has a certain kind of, everything difficult that's ever happened in Alaska was on Good Friday. The earthquake, the Exxon Valdez spill. Then we have Passover and Crypt Saturday and the moon in Scorpio trines Neptune, the sun enters Taurus. Easter Sunday, may it be. Earth Day on Monday, Sun and Uranus, nature's evolutionary genius trickster, are conjoined. How wonderful. So, first, before we bring in our splendid and perfect for today guest, as we honor Bicycle Day tomorrow, a little shout out to the New Living Expo, to Ken Kaufman, who is a great and kind guy. The New Living Expo will be April 26th through the 28th at the San Mateo Event Center, newlivingexpo.com. It's its 18th year. It will be the great and the near great presenting the usual and unusual suspects. The guest from Visionary Activist Show, Dr. Ken Pelletier, psychic James Van Praagh, Graham Hancock, Marianne Williamson, a bunch of people, great ally of mine, Ellie Painted Crow, on the Native panel. So all wonderfulness to those teams. I will not be there this year, but wishing it all well, because it's a great place to gather. And then on Saturday, April 27th, the Cultural Conservancy has a beautiful event, the Guardians of the Waters Art Show, Workshop, and Community Celebration, Saturday, April 27th, 9:30 a.m. to 5 p.m. Let's see how you can find out more about that. Nicola at nativeland.org. That should do it. With wonderful workshops on healing, dream weaving, relationship to corn, honoring the water, and so on. So thank you, team. Now, more than perfectly, we welcome the return of Martin A. Lee for ongoing entheo-endogenous indigenuity at this full moon holy week. Happy birthday, KPFA and LSD, and Bicycle Day tomorrow. Martin A. Lee is the director of Project CBD and the author of several books, including the fantastic Smoke Signals, A Social History of Marijuana, Medical, Recreational, and Scientific. Mine is earmarked in books and underlined. And Acid Dreams, The Complete Social History of LSD, the CIA, the 60s, and Beyond. So he co-authored Acid Dreams in 1985. Lee went on to co-found Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. You've been so busy. In 1986, in order to eliminate corporate and establishment media bias, he served as the first editor of the organization's publication Extra, and later became its publisher. He co-authored his second book, Unreliable Sources, A Guide to Detecting Bias in News Media. And he is most recognized as an investigative journalist. He was awarded the Pope Foundation Award for Investigative Journalism in 1994. He covered the medical cannabis movement for years in the pages of O'Shaughnessy before founding Project CBD, projectcbd.org. Welcome, Martin.
Thanks. Good to be with you. Do you hear me okay? We're set up here with the microphone?
We're pretty good. We're pretty good. This is a great stride forward. So I did find out let's start with Bicycle Day that you reminded me is tomorrow, and there's such a lot of resonance for the fun of it. So on Bicycle Day, and you will explain to our dedicated listeners what that is, but the sun was in Aries and the moon was in Libra. It was a full moon Aries Libra like it is now. Right? So it's a reset button. So that's adorable. And it has many, many connections to your own chart, which we might explore. So remind everybody, Bicycle Day, yes.
Well, it's interesting that the astrological information is similar today to what it was, I guess it's now 76 years ago, that Dr. Right. Albert Hofmann, the Swiss chemist working at Sandoz Pharmaceuticals, experimented with LSD for the first time consciously, wittingly, and had a very powerful experience because he thought he took a very tiny dose, 250 micrograms, almost negligible. He assumed it really wouldn't do anything. And this happened 3 days after he accidentally absorbed some LSD through his skin and had the first LSD trip known to humankind. That was on April 16th and April 19th, 1943. He decided to experiment again to see, what is really going on here, because he couldn't fathom that such a tiny amount could have been absorbed through his skin and had such a profound experience. And that second trip on will be the anniversary tomorrow, was so powerful that he had to stop work and he ended up bicycling home to kind of take it easy, take the rest of the day off and see if he's going to survive this in very intense experience. And therefore it's called Bicycle Day, because he wrote later that while he was bicycling home, he felt he wasn't actually moving at all, because his whole body image was quite different than usual. And this has become now a day to celebrate the discovery of this amazing compound, LSD.
Well, wait, there's more amazingness to come, because, Trickster is scheduling us. So I derived the birth time and everything from the careful notes from an article by Darren Hapdaddy-Smith, and Albert Hoffman saying, "It gave me an inner joy, an open-mindedness, a gratefulness, open eyes, and an internal sensitivity for the miracles of creation. I think that in human evolution it has never been as necessary to have this substance, LSD. It is just a tool to turn us into what we're supposed to be." That was from a speech on his 100th birthday. Go, Albert. That's really wonderful. And then the notes. See, this is great. And I remember my late great ally, Jim Lewis, saying, he was a Swiss chemist. He kept very careful notes. So at 4:20 p.m. on April 19th, as the sun and moon were waxing, just like they are right now, he ingested orally. Although in these notes, it said it took 250 micrograms of LSD, which the writer here says is about 2.5 doses, because he had an unpleasant initial time. But then he said, I woke completely fresh, and I had the feeling of seeing the world as fresh and wonderful as the very first day. When he walked out into his garden after rainfall, everything glistened and sparkled in a fresh new light. The world was as if newly created. But one more cool thing, two more cool things, and then I want to toss it back to you and your splendid article that came out today CBD. What is your website again?
ProjectCBD.org.
Thank you very much. Okay, that's good. Because just for the fun of it, so years ago, Jim Lewis, who is the founder, the astrocartography ancestor ally, and he said, so at the time when he consciously doses at 4:20 p.m. on April 19th, Jim Lewis said, "Let's look at the chart of, what was going on in San Francisco." And we go, "Ooh, Uranus, Trickster, and Venus are right on the ascendant in San Francisco," indicating where it would have some of its most profound and liberating experimental kind of dynamic. But for you, Martin Lee, there are, images for each degree of the zodiac. And so on that bicycle day, Mercury was at 14 plus Taurus, and when you were born, 14 plus Taurus is rising. You are its voice, and the image for it is really great. It's the image is a stranger walks into town in the midst of a wild windstorm, wearing a silk top hat and carrying a large black bag. The doctor, magician, controller of hidden natural forces, the occult, maintaining a strong instinctual connection to nature despite all external sophistication, divination. Well, that's pretty good for the birth of LSD, right? And that's pretty good for yourself and its connection, don't you think?
Interesting to know. And I think we should all be very grateful that it was Dr. Albert Hoffman who made this discovery, because he was always a nature mystic. That's what he brought into the experience. And just something to recount, I was actually at the birthday party of Albert Hoffman's 100th birthday. It was actually a conference in Switzerland. And there was a really beautiful moment you just excerpted some of his comments that day when he talked to the group. And he is now, he was 100 years old at the time, and he was in good shape. He strode onto the stage without a cane.
Yeah, and people said he was very, very flirty, right? He was a very flirty guy.
He tended to be that way, but he was, all in good fun. I mean, he was not a chauvinist or something like that. He was a good man. Yeah. But one thing he said that was so beautiful, that he looked at the audience. There was 1,000 people there. This took place in Basel, Switzerland, which near his home. And, LSD had been, he had referred to it in a book by that title as his problem child, because of all that transpired in the '60s and thereafter, and the cultural and social political controversies that swirled around the drug. But he looked at this group, and he's in looking at an audience, a wide age demographic, people with many colored hair, it was quite a diverse group, and he went as if he was embracing the group. He put his hands out and he said, "When I look at you today, I don't see a problem child. I see my prodigy." And it was a beautiful, beautiful moment. And it's not something that really was shared, I think, subsequently in people writing about this. But I was really quite struck by that. And I think he always he was a good person to be representing, what he discovered. We were very, very lucky for that. And I think, that's something that bodes well for, hopefully, for the future of what's going to transpire for this. And because we are really in a psychedelic renaissance today. That's what struck me when you talk about these astrological conjunctions and formations and how similar they were for what happened 76 years ago when he actually discovered the effects of the drug. We really are in a revival, and it's not something that necessarily everybody notices, but certainly Michael Pollan's book that came out within the last year is a big part of that. And it's now that it's sort of shorn up some of its associations from the 1960s, which I don't mind personally, but for many people that's a big issue. It's being looked at again with a renewed sense of respectability, that there's something profound here, that it may have real medical benefits, and many people are beginning, or at least willing, to take another look at this.
Right. And we want to, I think, thoroughly delve into the really great article, Psychedelics and Cannabis Therapeutics, at cbdproject.org, because it's really rich. But there's one more just quirky, against all odds, cool resonance between you and the bicycle ride. There are key angles that we look at, and there's a rare one called a quintile at 72 degrees, and it's got to be kind of almost exact. And so when the bicycle ride at 4:20 p.m. on April 19th, 1943 in Basel, Switzerland, there's a beautiful Mercury, that's the medicine man degree that I just read, quintile Mars in Pisces, irresistible eloquence. And a wonderful colleague of mine recently said the quintile is irresistible eloquence, but it's also the capacity to open doors between worlds. So Mercury, quintiles, Mars in the bicycle ride chart, and in your chart too, Martin Lee, Mercury, quintiles, Mars. And these are rare aspects, and we go, "Oh, look at you, that's so good." There is a baton being handed on there, and to open doors. And so here we are, as you say, in the opening of the article, yes, it is a psychedelic renaissance. And as you mentioned, Michael Pollan, a great popularizer, people going, "Oh, well, that looks okay." And then, I just want, maybe you can guide us through all of the things and I like saying, the entheo-endogenous indigenuity, and the whole realm of endogenous. It's an entheo-endogenous indigenuity renaissance, really. And there's so much, you referenced that Dr. Albert Hoffman said, described LSD as medicine for the soul. And yeah, like yourself, I do not disavow the. I was a tiny teen, but highly experimental. I remember actually in eighth grade, I wrote an essay on psychedelic cultural something or other, and I read the Life magazine that said, "If you take LSD, it doesn't change you because it's not you anymore." I'm like, I must get this as soon as possible. If they're saying this about it, it must be subversive and fantastic, right? So there's that. But and you reference cannabis also as a plant teacher. In our past conversation, some ways back, I'd mentioned that Culpepper's Herbal had attributed Saturn to cannabis, and people go, "No, that doesn't make sense." But it does. When you say cannabis is a plant teacher of sorts, that would be very Saturn.
There's an interesting story about Culpepper. Apparently, he was quite a man around town in London, because he was claiming to people, particularly to women, that he had created an herbal formula to restore a woman's virginity. But I think other than that, you know, he certainly bequeathed us a very, very important book, The Complete Herbal, which does mention hemp or cannabis as a very important medicine. And one of the references in there, he said that there are so many uses for hemp therapeutically, medicinally, that was so well known to British people, particularly British housewives, is the way he referred to it, that he didn't even need to list all the uses for hemp. And I think that very much corresponds to what the science is telling us today about cannabis and its versatility as a therapeutic modality. And I think it's you know, at its core, it relates to something that is why psychedelics also have a medicinal effect. I think there's an overlap between cannabis and psychedelics in that way. I mean, one could argue that cannabis is a psychedelic as well, but that gets into a whole discussion about dosage and are we talking macrodosing, microdosing, and what's going on in that respect. It's all very interesting, and people are experimenting once again with great zeal.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, and all that you mentioned in reference and your dedication and Michael Pollan's book and all of this, you know, but in the astromythology, you know, Neptune dreams and vision and Pisces in its own home realm. And the way I keep seeing this repeatedly is as though all the critters on this planet, all the flora, fauna, meet backstage going, what are we going to do about the humans and their rude lack of manners and they're destroying everything? We got to either kill them or heal them. We'll do both. But let's, you know, but where I want to toss it back to you is that, you know, let's make everything that has ever moved humans to conscious kinship and participation in the whole choreography of creation available in a fresh new way, whether it's, you know, entheogens or cannabis or poetry or, you know, or philosophy, or let's make those, that's also part of it, because the Renaissance you're describing, you know, is made maybe more accessible through these sacraments of kinship, which is how I like to think of them. You know, but again, anything that restores our sense of participatory kinship, really, in the way that and the miraculous in the way that Hoffman was describing. So, you go into, you know, a lot, you know, magic mushrooms, ayahuasca, peyote, rue, iboga. Have you done iboga?
No, I have not done iboga. I've done most of what you just mentioned, but not iboga. Yep. It's an African psychedelic
root.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The grandmother, grandfather of all, because it's a journey of about 24 hours in which you don't want to move. But it does, you know, but as we look around at corruption and everything, I love some of the iboga practices, which was a leader upon inauguration in Africa would have to do this so that he could see all of his befoibments and also see clearly and in an objective way the opportunities of his rulership. And I go, let's bring that back. I think that would be a really good thing to do. And maybe like all of these in different ways, you know, it brings you to the center of all stories, that there's a fountain of stories. But what was particularly intriguing, and wherever you want to go is completely fine. You know, psilocybin, you know, and magic mushrooms, psilocybe mushrooms are now being studied, and there's the whole, you know, MMDA and the Australian governmental official who said, I've taken MMDA and it was really a good thing, you know. So it's, you know, and then people, of course, threw shoes at her. But you know, there's this. So can you guide us maybe on your page 4 from psilocybe, ayahuasca, MMDA, and then Special K and the neurogenesis, the fertilizer for the brain part? That's fascinating.
I mean, it's very interesting. It's clear that the psychedelics, and I prefer that term actually to more than anything. It literally means just mind manifesting. It's a neutral term. And I think it's appropriate, even though it has those day glow associations from the 60s. As a term, I think it's really the most accurate in a way. When we say entheogen, which I respect the term, but it is in some ways imposing an experience on the plant rather than letting simply the plant speak to us. But because, you know, for the CIA.
How so? Say more.
I mean, when you look back on the history of LSD, we can focus on that entheogen or psychedelic, if you will, and you look at the different groups in society that got involved with it going back to the 1950s, you had the chemists who were using it as a tool to study how the mind worked. It was something that was opening up new vistas in neuroscience, generating new theories about schizophrenia and mental illness. It was a very exciting compound for scientists to be working with. At the same time, you had the CIA getting into LSD as a secret weapon, as an espionage weapon that they would use unwittingly on someone to slip something into their drink so they would go crazy or act foolishly or spill the beans. Whatever. That was the CIA's idea. Very different approach later on in the 1960s where people were talking about it as a mind expansion substance, not as a mind control. And so you have these different points of view of therapists were also using in the late 50s to expedite psychotherapy and so forth. U.S. Army was using it or attempting to develop a psychochemical weapon, which they ultimately did, but not was it wasn't based on LSD. So you had these different groups that were embracing LSD for very, very different reasons, and they were all very enthusiastic about it for their own purposes. So, you know, what can we draw from that? Is it then correct to say that LSD or mushrooms or the other plants are entheogens intrinsically? That wasn't the case for the CIA and for the U.S. Army. For the CIA, it was an anxiety-producing drug. So the conclusion I get, the one common ground that unites all these disparate points of view around LSD is that it's all about new possibilities and envisioning in some ways grandiose possibilities, and that LSD and the other psychedelics are really potentiators of possibility. That's really the common ground to all these things. And for Timothy Leary and Allen Ginsberg, it was a potentially a ticket to a better society. It was they projected the healing potential of LSD onto a social landscape. You know, for the CIA, it was something about anxiety, not about mystical experiences or utopias. But the tricky thing here is that I guess I'm reminded of this quote from Alfred North Whitehead. He had the phrase, "the fallacy of misplaced concreteness." And this is a tricky thing with these substances because they're so powerful, the experiences, that it's very easy for a person to end up projecting onto the plant or the compound their own experience. So for the CIA, their agents were having bad trips. So they actually defined the drug in the documents as an anxiety-producing drug, as if somehow that was embedded in the molecular structure of LSD. Of course, that wasn't the experience for other people. So what's right and what's wrong? Well, it's sort of all right and all wrong. But I think that there's something that we need to keep in mind about these substances, particularly in the context of this revival, which is happening at the same time of this enormous social stress and the planetary stress, that there's a tendency to want to look at these substances almost like a Hail Mary pass, and somehow this is going to get us beyond global warming. If everybody turned on and realized the interconnectedness to nature that these substances are conducive to generating those kind of experiences, that this is going to be our way past this tremendous crisis we're in. But I think that these substances are always context dependent. If we do it right, it's entheogenic. We do it wrong, it's like the CIA and the Army. It then becomes anxiety-producing, basically. And the fact that it's always context-dependent, these experiences, I think, on the one hand, it's both a blessing and a curse, you know, because the blessing is if it's context-dependent, then we can influence the context of how we approach these substances, the respect we show them, that we can influence the experiences that we're going to have from them and maximize their therapeutic potential. On the one hand. On the other hand, it's very, very seductive, too, because it's very easy to lose sight of this notion of the fallacy of misplaced concreteness, projecting onto the plant, onto the compounds, experiences that we have in our own minds, as if they were concretely embedded in the plant or the substance itself. That can be very tricky and can lead one astray. And there's a constant tension I find, you know, in recent years, going to these psychedelic revival conferences, whether it's Breaking Convention in London or there's a great conference every other year in Prague, which has always been a center of psychedelic research in the Czech Republic, or there was recently a meeting at Esalen in California, which I participated in with a bunch of other people. You know, there's always this messianic feel that's around, you know, because these experiences are so powerful And we're in such basically deep shit we're in right now as a culture, as a country, on the planet itself, you know, that there's a tendency to throw that Hail Mary pass or think that that's the way it could work. And maybe it can, you know, maybe this is a key to moving on, but I think we place too much on the substance themselves and not on our relationship with it. It can really lead us astray. It's sort of a long-winded way of commenting about entheogenic or using that phrase, which I respect a lot. But I kind of err on the side of that neutral phrase, psychedelic.
Right, because entheogenic means what?
Oh, it means that, you know, the God within, you know, the God in the plant.
Right.
The spirituality is embedded in the plant, and it gives it to us. And I'm not saying that that's incorrect. I think there's a lot to that. I just think we have to be careful about how we relate to it, because it's it can be very misleading to rely on something as a, you know, this is going to be the messianic ticket to a better world. You're in the same world as you started, and you might look at it a little bit differently. But
right. I like to think that the gods are willing to do 50%, but not 51%. Say again, psychedelics literally means what etymologically?
Mind manifesting. And it ties into why it was considered good for therapy. That it helped expedite therapy, and that brought up things from the unconscious, if you will, if you look at, you know, mental structures that way, makes the unconscious conscious, expedite therapy in that way. And, you know, that's one of the great values of these substances if used well. But I think it goes beyond that, because we're getting reports from scientists and from others that the psychedelics have antidepressant qualities, that they're good for dealing with serious trauma, for substance abuse issues. Time and time again, we see these themes coming up where the psychedelics, whether they be something like an MDMA, known as ecstasy, or a special K, you know, ketamine, or the plant-based psychedelics, the mushrooms, ayahuasca, lysergic acid, that they do have this way of sort of resetting the brain, if you will, and they have significant antidepressant effects. And the question is why? And I think that's what ties into what we call the endocannabinoid system, the system of receptors and whatnot in our own brains and body that respond directly to cannabis, because it's that system, the endocannabinoid system, that actually regulates the process of neurogenesis, which is really about creating new brain cells. And there are areas of the brain, particularly in the hippocampus, where we are constantly creating new brain cells, just as we are constantly destroying cells that need to be destroyed or repairing those that can be repaired. This is a process that is ongoing. We refer to that as homeostasis, but it's actually not static. It's a very dynamic process of cellular repair and death and birth. And it's the endocannabinoid system that actually governs that process. It takes place in areas of the brain that are heavily concentrated with cannabinoid receptors, as they call, which, you know, respond directly to the cannabis plant. Well, it turns out that the psychedelics also work through that same system, not directly. LSD doesn't bind to the same receptor that THC does that gets us high. But it interacts with that in other ways. And I think that's really interesting, because it provides a scientific understanding of why these things have these properties of having an enduring antidepressant effect. And it's something that we see now with ketamine clinics that are popping up all over the states, because
Hold that thought, because this is completely great. I want to go into all of this, you know, neurogenesis,
sure,
and brain remediation. We're going to take a very short break in a moment. We'll be right back. And then I also just want to bring up Mary Meyer and JFK and LSD in the White House. But back into endocannabinoid systems and all of that. Our wonderful, perfect for today guest is Martin A. Lee. His website is projectcbd.org, and we'll be right back after this very short Taj Mahal break.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She shook the constellation and dazzled them crossed his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tortoise cry. Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh. on. Telegraph my indigo skyship, make its voyage long. Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey, and our Perfect for Today guest is Martin A. Lee. His website is projectcbd.org, and we are honoring many things, the psychedelic renaissance and Bicycle Day tomorrow and all of that. And then just a little shout out to KPFA is a sponsor of the New Living Expo, organized by Ken Kaufman, who is a very great stand-up kind guy. April 26th through 28th at the San Mateo Event Center, newlivingexpo.com. The great, the near great, the usual, the unusual suspects. But really, a lot of these gatherings, it's who you connect with and who you connect with in the marketplace. Well worth the adventure. So yes, all right, back to brain regenesis and many things. But I did want to put in the margins here. It's not, you know, Tim Leary was not always a completely reliable narrator, but Mary Meyer, who was the only real kind of grown-up woman that JFK had an affair with, also born on my birthday, we share that birthday, but she definitely smoked marijuana with JFK in the White House and purportedly took a low-dose LSD trip with John F. Kennedy Jr., John F. Kennedy. And it was right after that that he gave an amazing speech at American University. You can find it online. It's just amazing. And it's very trippy. It was so profound in its compassion that Khrushchev played it throughout Russia because JFK said, enough of this war. It probably sealed his death warrant. Enough of this war. You know, the Russians have suffered tremendously. We have enormous compassion for them and kinship. And it went on kind of like that. And people were like, whoa. It looked like an LSD post possible event. And we go, all right. So, yeah, but your point is well taken. We want to, you know, toss messiah-ness into cauldron. We want to keep discerning and all of that. And there is no one thing, and it's all a kind of collaborative dynamic. But then you get to this this article that is now published this morning on projectcbd.org, this great article, Psychedelics and Cannabis Therapeutics. And that's where I, right before the break, you are the endocannabinoid system and about actual, well, I'm looking at the, what you talk about, ketamine, and that it inhibits NMDA, and this triggers the production of a chemical known as brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF, which is, as you write, described as fertilizer for the brain. It stimulates the growth of new brain cells, neurogenesis. Oh, dive us into this. This is really thrilling.
It's a fascinating area, and it's very, very fundamental. And neurogenesis, which is happening all the time in certain areas of the brain, but sometimes it can happen in a depleted way, and that's linked to clinical depression when that's the case. And one can boost the production of new brain cells literally by certain lifestyle habits, by consuming certain substances like cannabis, like LSD. Scientists have documented it has this effect of boosting neurogenesis, and that's the creation of new brain cells. And not just that, but it's involved in what's referred to as synaptogenesis, actually creating new nerve endings and connections between nerves, and also neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to adapt to new experiences, to injuries. You know, the brain is always changing, and the way it changes can be very much influenced by how we live and what we consume. And these very powerful tools, these psychedelics, can literally change the way the brain works. It can kind of take us out of the brain habits. There's a phrase that neuroscientists refer as the neurons that fire together, wire together. Well, the brain can get stuck in habits, and psychedelics are an amazing way to sort of, you know, break out of those habits and to increase neuroplasticity, increase adaptability. And that's what these substances seem to do. And that's one thing they share in common. And there's science to show this, that in recent years, in the number of articles, for example, you mentioned ketamine, which is a legal drug. It's actually an anesthetic. Something that's used for animals and so forth. But it's being tolerated now, off-label use for depression. And there are ketamine clinics where people who are clinically depressed go to have an ketamine experience, and with oftentimes very good results. And it seems that it jolts them out of their brain patterns that are unhealthy, if you will. I'm oversimplifying. But it's been documented now that ketamine's effects are mediated, if you will, by the endocannabinoid system, that its pain-killing effects and its antidepressant effects are conveyed through the same set of receptors and pathways that THC and CBD work through. And that's quite interesting that there is this sort of fundamental unifying factor that brings all these different substances together. And that's a relatively recent development in science, that this is understood to be happening this way. And I think it's very exciting. It means we can influence how our brain works in a positive way toward healing. And that's something that should be empowering, actually.
Right. Well, there's so much in what you say. I'm scribbling. So just to go back over some of that, because you said there's a kind of neurogenesis also, which is related to depression or a negative kind of neurogenesis. What did you mean by that?
I mean, sort of think of it as a level of this is constantly happening in certain areas of the hippocampus in the brain. There are certain areas that have been identified where neurogenesis occurs, where new neurons, new brain cells, new stem cells are created. This is a constant thing. But if that's happening on a depleted level, on a low level, that could be associated with various health problems, including depression. And if you can boost neurogenesis, you can accelerate it or increase it, as cannabis does, as psychedelic drugs do, it can help depression. And this is what the scientists and physicians are learning, that there's very profound effects and that in terms of an antidepressant qualities or properties of these substances, and that is directly linked to the fact that they are catalysts for neurogenesis. This is what you might say, it's an emerging paradigm, but they've nailed it. They understand that this is what's going on.
So, yeah, completely resonant. Yes, brain. Our brains are very happy hearing this, going, And in the mythology, you know, we're always adding, you know, in the astrological, astro-mythological language, just different aspects of the psyche that connect to the world. So I'm very fond of way, way out in the Kuiper Belt, beyond Pluto, is a planet called Eris, a goddess of disruption and discord. But she is an ally, you know, and it's like, what would we like disrupted? Where, you know, polluting industries, what would we like disrupted, or, you know, to disrupt discord, to come back into accord, you know, as you say, you know, disrupt habits, brain habits, and we go, that's really fun too. So in your research and possibly your experience, is this also the microdosing of LSD, even the microdosing of cannabis? The microdosing also is a happy thing with neurogenesis?
It could well be, and we should emphasize here that there are many things that can influence neurogenesis. I think Paul Stamets has gotten to explain to us that with some of the mushrooms and the fungi that he's been emphasizing are important for ecological and human health. They're not necessarily psychedelic, things like cordyceps or reishi mushrooms or lion's mane, and yet they are all neurogenic in the sense they have the same quality as some of the psychedelics, is boosting neurogenesis, neuroplasticity. You know, getting exercise boosts neurogenesis. You know, it's a matter of how we live too. It's not just these magical substances that we take to make it all better. No, it's a constant everyday thing that we should be thinking about. Healthy lifestyle means more neurogenesis, and there's many things that can affect that. You know, that's what we need to keep in mind, because ultimately we have to come down from the trip and we're planted back in the world, and we have to live in ways that make sense and hopefully reflect, you know, the insights we glean during the amazing 6 to 8 or 12 hours that one might be experiencing under the influence of a psychedelic.
Well, that is a real worthy theme. You know, I've been involved with many, you know, resurgent kind of journeying groups, and it's like, oh, wonderful. But where are people changing? Is it integrated? Is it, you know, not necessarily, you know, it goes into the category, just because you fill in the blank, does not necessarily make whatever the thing is. I mean, just because you do massive doses of DMT, just because you do ayahuasca every weekend, just because you, does not necessarily mean anything, which, you know, to your well-taken point about discerning, but it does want to be a partnering. And is this something to which you're dedicated, but also that you see more? Like, well, how do we really partner and honor, you know, this? And if cannabis for the fun of it is associated with the planet Saturn, it's like, well, how do we work with that as a dedication, not so much a kind of, you know, what, how do these substances, well, can is it okay to phrase it to you as like, how do they want us to work with them?
I'm okay with that. I think we have to respect these substances, and I do see them as plant teachers in a way. You know, they're not all the same. You know, taking a few puffs of a joint is not the same as dropping a high dose of LSD. Obviously, cannabis is a much milder experience. And yet, when you look at microdosing, it's a different thing. And I see microdosing as something like LSD or mushrooms is much more in common with CBD, which is not intoxicating, nor is microdosing intoxicating. And yet they work through similar pathways in the brain. And with similar results, CBD is now notorious for having antidepressant properties. And I think, again, it's tied into the fact that CBD is a neurogenic compound. It promotes neurogenesis, but it doesn't get you high like THC or a strong dose of LSD would. And yet I think there's a lot in common with microdosing psychedelics and CBD, just as there's something significant in common with the high dose of THC, a strong edible, or eating a lump of hash or something like that, with a psychedelic experience. You can hallucinate as if you're on mushrooms if you take a high dose of eat a really strong edible. And some people have difficult experiences with that. We're not advocating here. We're just pointing out that there are these interesting avenues of convergence, whether it's high or low dose, and you can get to some very interesting places and using different routes, but you can get to places that are healthier and provide insight and can, you know, banish suicidal thoughts or send their depression into remission. This is what people are saying when they microdose LSD or use CBD for that matter. It might seem worlds apart. In some ways, there's nothing less likely in terms of being similar to LSD and CBD, because CBD is really powerfully unpsychedelic, if you will. And yet, when you take a low dose of LSD, it's a lot like CBD. That's my opinion. I think that as the science proceeds, we're going to see how that's fleshed in more. You know, one common ground is they actually bind to the same receptor. There's a receptor called 5-HT2A. That's a serotonin receptor. Serotonin is the natural endogenous ligand that binds to this receptor and activates it. Well, that's the psychedelic receptor. And when when LSD binds to that receptor, you have a full-blown LSD experience, assuming you've had at least 100 micrograms or something like that. Well, CBD also binds to that receptor, it turns out, and has different effects. But it just goes to show, you know, the convergence here between the cannabis realm and the psychedelic realm is very deep-rooted, and there's a lot there, and hopefully we'll have all sorts of research informing us about this, not just from scientists and doctors, but from people who are just experimenting and sharing their experiences, as we're hearing about and microdosing.
Yeah, and then there's all kinds of, you know, cute research. I think it was like 10 years ago that there was a neuroscience paper that said, we've noticed that chocolate and cannabis seem to enhance each other. It's like, who would have ever thought of that? Who would have ever thought of eating chocolate while high? And then again, just to repeat, because it's so, you know, interesting, cannabis, it turns out, you write, is another neurogenic substance that spurs the creation of new brain cells, unlike alcohol, which disrupts adult neurogenesis in animal models, right? And that also presumably is a question of dosage.
Yeah, and also how you approach it and use it. If you're getting stoned, you know, all throughout the day, every day, the effects will be different from if you're using it occasionally or whatever, because overuse or chronic use results in a downregulation of the receptors that regulate neurogenesis. So overuse might not be the most effective way in terms of addressing depression, for example, which is directly related to neurogenesis, or be the opposite. Antidepressant effects would be related to neurogenesis. So, you know, it's not a slam dunk. We need to learn how to use these things. Not that there's one way that's the right way, but everyone has to figure out their own relationship to these plant teachers. I think, there's a cliche, almost a phrase. I'm in a relationship with the plant. You hear about that with people who use cannabis. And it's a good way of thinking about it. People, at least in my own experience, we can get very heavily involved with it. Then we back off. We take a vacation from it. It is like a relationship that you keep working at and reforming, keep refreshing. Getting into the bag of the same thing over and over again a lot each day is not the most effective way to get the healing benefits from cannabis. And obviously, you can't do that with a strong psychedelic. You can't be tripping every day like that. That's inconceivable. But microdosing, people do it. Sequential
every day.
Days,
no, I know some people who micro. Yeah, I know some people who microdose every day, and it's like, ooh, because unlike what you'd said, I found that even 10 micrograms, 20 micrograms, it's like, it's pretty, you can feel that, you're dead LSD microdosing.
Yeah,
it's like,
it does not
mix with caffeine, I have found. Going, okay. Whoa, no, that's not good. So it is quirky, but again, just in what you say, just to repeat it so it can sit in there, low-dose LSD and CBD bind to the same receptors. How interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do. So exactly what that means, we don't fully understand. But what we do know is that when you take a psychedelic drug, somehow it makes your own endogenous cannabinoid compounds, these marijuana-like compounds that our brain is always creating. They're called endocannabinoids. That LSD somehow provokes a spike upregulation of our own endogenous cannabinoids. And it's not entirely clear of how that's happening, but it is happening. So when you take LSD, you're actually boosting your own cannabinoid signaling in your brain. And again, that has profound healing effects. It has neuroprotective effects, antioxidant effects, so forth and so on. And I don't think that's generally been realized about LSD until recently, that it has this effect. So these systems, the cannabis system, the psychedelics, they're very much interrelated. And that's what the article that we just posted at Project CBD is about.
Right. So, again, what you just said references also that the LSD, even on a microdose level, will boost the protective antioxidants, yeah?
Yeah, and the interesting thing is what we're seeing is that the lower doses have a more profound effect. That's also the same with cannabinoids, as they're called. A low dose can have a more profound therapeutic effect than a higher dose. It's sort of inverted the way we typically think about it. And there's actually been, clear science that shows this, that there have been some clinical studies. How is cannabis most effective for pain? It is an excellent painkiller. And the studies that were done by GW Pharmaceuticals show that a combination of THC and CBD together, about 20 milligrams is really a maximum benefit for pain. And if you increase it to 40 milligrams, this is over an entire day stretched out, it still has a painkilling effect, but not as effective. And if you boost it to 80 milligrams, the painkilling effect goes away. So it's completely inverted as we think about things. And we have to rethink our premises about how medicine works, because typically, you take a painkiller, it works a bit, or you can always take more and it works better. That's not how psychedelics work necessarily, and cannabis works. It's a much more trickster-like concept of healing, I think, that we have to appreciate to get the most out of these things.
That's so great. Because again, it's an antidote to the excesses of Jupiter, the gorge theory of pleasure, going more must be better, the whole cake, the whole thing, which is certainly a kind of American habit. So that's really intriguing. And again, Saturn limits and dedication and reverence and respect are those kind of realms. So the trickster quality. So 20 milligrams of CBDs and THC have a pain killing effect over a day. 40 milligrams reduces that effect. That's what you said, right?
Yeah, it'll still be there. At least this from this is actually clinical trials on people that have shown this. And then if you go higher, then you really can eliminate the pain killing effect. So that's what the science shows, and that's what people are reporting, you know. But again, everybody has got different metabolism and different ways of absorbing these things. I have friends who drop a tab of acid, and they wouldn't even get high. And meanwhile, I'm like way out there. And how does that work? And then we know for cannabis, some people take the tiniest little bit of one puff of a joint, and they find it's really uncomfortable. It makes them anxious. You got to peel them off the ceiling. And other people can smoke all day, no problem. So it's really a matter of how we metabolize these things and how they're going to affect us. And we can metabolize psychedelics differently from person to person, same with cannabis. So we need to keep that in mind as well before, make overarching grand statements about what this will always do or will guarantee. It's very much, again, context dependent, and the context ultimately, so much rests on who's taking it and for what reason and how.
Yeah, and is it a party with a purpose? Is there a sense?
Yeah.
Also with what you said about LSD, does that work in a resonant way with the psilocybe mushrooms and their relationship to the cannabinoid system as well?
I think so. I heard Paul Stamets speak not that long ago. He's the great mushroom. Mushroom man who's taught us so much about the fungi and how important they are and what they can do. But he also said that lower doses oftentimes have a greater impact therapeutically and otherwise than the higher doses, which corresponds to what we know about cannabinoid therapeutics. And it might be in part because, again, working through the same molecular pathways, working through the same channels in the brain and body. It's the endocannabinoid system. And just to put that in perspective, we all have these, for lack of a better phrase, marijuana-like compounds called endocannabinoids, and they're part of something called the endocannabinoid system. And that's why cannabis works. That's why you get high when you smoke a joint, because we have these receptors in this system in the body. And with CBD, it's a little bit different. We don't get high from CBD like you would from THC, nor does CBD bind to these cannabinoid receptors directly like THC does. What CBD does, it acts as a endocannabinoid reuptake inhibitor. I know that's a mouthful, but what it means is that when you take a product with CBD, it actually delays the body's metabolism of your own endogenous cannabinoid. These things are constantly being created, and they do a lot of very important things in terms of neuroprotection, maintaining balance, and so forth. When you take CBD, it delays these compounds they're absorbed back into the cell where they get decomposed, they get broken down. If you delay that, you're actually boosting the levels of your own endogenous cannabinoids. So that's what happens when you take CBD. So it's kind of like a natural high, if you will. That's different from how THC works. THC binds directly to these receptors and turns them on in a powerful way, where CBD allows our own endogenous cannabinoids to get a little bit of an uplift and then bind to receptors in that way. So it's more like a runner's high, CBD is, where THC, we know, it can be really great if you like it, and if you don't, it can be very, very uncomfortable, and that depends a lot on how people metabolize THC.
Right. As you bring your splendid article to a close, you go, LSD has a propensity for catalyzing intensely meaningful moments of vision, those seminal light bulb moments, the explosive epiphanies which alter mental constructs and transform how we look at things. And then, of course, what we're underlining, but integrating those insights and applying them in daily life is easier said than done. Harder not to, I like to quip. But it does take some intention and dedication. Broadening our horizons, you write, doesn't necessarily change our immediate circumstance. No, that's good. But it's so interesting right now with the dispensaries and the things and the pedigrees and the stories and the lineage and many informed people at dispensaries. You can say, my husband here who has a license and he's got epilepsy, and they go, oh, well, this is what studies show that this is the strand for you that you might want to, or whatever, or I don't want to feel anxious. I want to do that. Try. So it is this great experimental renaissance now, right? With more refinement.
Yeah, we've learned a lot in California the last 20 years. It's actually been more than 20 years now since cannabis was legalized for therapeutic use. And actually that experiment, preceded the actual formal legalization. We've learned a lot. But we've had to learn a lot because we've had to relearn that relationship. We've been cut off from that plant as a result of prohibition, this completely inane policy when you consider, going back thousands of years, cannabis and these other plants we've been referring to and the fungi have been such important allies for human beings. And yet it's only been this weird moment in history, this relatively small stretch when you consider the whole historical vista. Since 1937, the plant is illegal, and it still is on a federal level. We shouldn't forget. So our relationship has been broken with that plant. Our understanding of how to relate to it has had to be relearned. And that's really what the medical marijuana laboratory experiment in democracy has been all about. Relearning how to relate to that plant in a positive way, whether it's for therapeutic use or for creative use or just to have some fun, all good as far as I'm concerned. That's part of what we've been, and that's a large part, I think, the impetus for the medical marijuana experiment. And it's largely a successful one. And we can see the results of how it's spread now. And the whole culture has been shifting around cannabis. We're in the midst of a pro-cannabis cultural shift. That has been definitely catalyzed by the reentry of CBD into the whole mix, which was only about 10 years ago when it was rediscovered in Northern California. That when I say rediscovered, I mean it was rediscovered as part of an important component in the plants that were being grown in the Emerald Triangle and elsewhere. I think we had forgotten about that largely because of prohibition and the emphasis on the part of the breeders and creating new strains and so forth. It was largely on getting high and creating, nice variations on the marijuana high, on the cannabis high. And as a result, the CBD aspect of it was sort of inadvertently bred out, genetically speaking, because CBD can balance THC. It can mitigate the high. What it does really, it lengthens the high, but also lowers the ceiling on the THC high. So you don't maybe get quite as high, but you'll be high for longer.
Say that last sentence again. I went off into a reverie. Just repeat that. Yeah.
Well, the important thing is how CBD and THC relate. We consider that the power couple of cannabis therapeutics. I know there's a big emphasis just on CBD now, but what CBD and THC, when they're there together, the CBD will lower the ceiling on the THC high, but lengthen the high. That's what it does.
Okay.
There's great gifts there because for some people they don't like to get high or they don't like to get very high. It's uncomfortable for them. But CBD will help people manage the psychoactivity. Hear the music.
I love this. It is the music. It's the exit stage right music. But thank you so much, Martin Ailey, and I love what you said. Also, really, it's about broken treaties, as coming back to all the plants and the animals and the critters as allies rather than colonizers. Right, as a respectful attitude. Anyway, there's so much in what you say, and I love thinking of this as a ongoing in perpetuity conversation. Thank you, Martin Ailey, and your website, projectcbd.org. Woof woof.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Right, and thanks always to Erica Bridgman and CoyoteNetworkNews.com, where these radio shows are archived, and also the wonderful link to Martin Ailey's article. We will reconvene next week. Thank you, team.